A recent article about gym class in The Atlantic has created quite an uproar in the PE teaching community and beyond. The article digs into a study that shows that PE does not seem to have a positive impact on kids' health or even their overall school performance. It can actually lead to truancy and other discipline problems because kids hate it so much. So hold up. I wore awful shorts and did push-ups and dodged balls being hurled at my face, and that did not even help me in life. I feel so cheated. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about PE, what it's trying to teach, and in a perfect world, what gym class looks like. I'm here now with the author of that article, Aaliyah Wong from The Atlantic. Hi, Aaliyah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Talk to me about the response to your article.
Well, I've never gotten such intense response from people who loved PE, people who are PE teachers. Definitely a lot of PE haters. A lot of people, I may have triggered them into remembering back to their PE days, their stinky clothes, their mean teachers, their failure to run around the track, etc. It's been an outpouring for sure.
So dig in a little bit more and tell me about, we'll start with the negative responses and then we'll move to the sort of like defense of PE kind of responses.
Sure. So the negative responses kind of ran the gamut from just really sad stories about feeling bullied by their teachers, people who were convinced they weren't athletically competent, that they could never, ever manage to run in their lives or play a game, and maybe later in life found some activity that made them realize that, hey, I actually am good at sports. It just wasn't the kind of sports I was doing in PE. I heard stories of people who somehow found a way to get out of it. One person wrote me saying that she pretended to have a bee sting and had her friend rub holly leaves over her arm so that it would look like she actually did have a sting. I've heard people who said they just watched a lot of movies in gym class. And I've heard stories of people who basically, you know, were bullied by their peers because maybe they were overweight or just somehow awkward.
You know, you write a lot of articles in a national magazine. Is the volume of response and the like personal nature of it unusual?
I'd say it's definitely unusual. There have been a few pieces in the past that did generate this kind of response, although much different themes. But I think what did really strike me is just how visceral everyone reacted to this. I think one takeaway I think we can all agree on is that PE is one of those experiences in school that really implants itself in our brains, that it's hard to forget. We got a response from
someone. Because we remember it in our bodies.
Yes, I think so, yeah. I think it has that sort of, it really, you know, engages all the senses. It's like you say, it's obviously by definition a physical experience. You know, you're
and
not
it's gonna, social, too.
It's social, and whether it was really good or really bad, it's really going to, I think, define your sense of self at that age and then through your later years.
Do you feel like you almost should be a therapist responding to some of these letters?
I feel like I have been tapped as a de facto therapist. I don't know if I should be since I'm not qualified, but the outpouring of messages and emails from my own coworkers, from my friends in our text chat group, if from my relatives, it seems like they did seek out my support emotionally. and it's been, you know, it's been a delightful experience. I by no means have any scientific or licensed ability to provide that therapy, but I'm happy to talk about it, obviously.
Well, recap the study for us. What exactly did it show, and what are sort of the limits of it?
Sure. So, yeah, I think to start with the caveat is that it's very limited in scope because it was focused on one specific program in Texas. It was a $37 million grant program that was implemented in an attempt yes, to sort of improve the physical activity of children, but also boost their academic achievement and some of these other social-emotional outcomes that schools are trying to achieve. And it was a grant program, so it wasn't required, but schools that opted into it could get money for enhancing their PE programs, whether it was just buying more equipment, hiring more teachers, somehow expanding the curriculum. And one of the features of this is that it had to be a daily requirement, and it was for middle schoolers. And I think in that sense, it did have some unintended consequences. The fact that it was required daily, I think kids, especially middle schoolers, are just not going to respond well to something that they feel is forced on them every day. And I think particularly because it's middle school where bullying happens, you know, at a particularly high rate, kids are especially vulnerable. They're growing into their own skin, figuring themselves out. Since they're so vulnerable, and PE can be an experience that forces kids into situations that involve bullying, whether it's because they're overweight and can't, you know, run around the track, or if they're in the locker room and maybe, you know, aren't fully developed. There's just a whole range of scenarios that could expose them to bullying, and then it's
a landmine for a middle schooler.
And it can be a perfect storm for some of these things we're trying to avoid. And
well,
so that's why I think the outcome of the study wasn't only that it had little or no impact on sort of the core goals of physical improvement and academic improvement, but it also maybe compelled kids to just skip school rather than have to go to this class or to act out. And that's why they also saw increases in discipline problems.
So we've heard a lot about why people don't like gym when they look back on it, why what this study reveals that is maybe discouraging for gym teachers today. So talk to me about what the PE lovers have reached out to say to you.
Yeah, sure. So I really, really value those responses in general. I appreciate criticism as long as it's thoughtful and diplomatic. And I think it was a lot of PE teachers are really part of what I think of as this new generation of PE educators who are trying to sort of disrupt that stereotype of, you know, the tyrannical, cold and probably a very harsh PE teacher who just, you know, has a whistle around his neck and is yelling at you to run faster. I think these educators realize that PE is very much about social-emotional improvement, whether that's meditation, constant movement to get out what one teacher told me, the sillies, which I thought was a cool way of thinking about it. You know, kids have a lot of energy, and especially in this day and age, they have attention issues. So PE can really serve to sort of ameliorate some of those problems. And these teachers are recognizing that potential, and they're realizing that empathy is a really key part of their job, and are really trying to display that. And so there are
Different threads within
exactly.
The PE community.
Yeah. And so I think, and there's this also this school of thought that it's related, is that PE shouldn't just be this kind of standalone course where you jump rope and do some burpees or whatever. It's that it should be something that's integrated throughout the school curriculum, and it should, you know, consider recess a part of the program. It should consider maybe, you know, a morning, a lot of schools will do morning movement sessions, you know, just some yoga-like activities just to get the blood flowing and get them ready to start the day.
Well, I'm interested in your takeaway, not just from the study, but from the avalanche of feedback you've gotten.
Yeah, so, I mean, one takeaway, obviously, is that PE deserves more coverage. It deserves nuanced coverage. I really tried to make my story nuanced. I think a lot of people may have just seen the headline and reacted to that, which is common in this day and age on Twitter. But I think PE is something that really really affected a lot of people in different ways. So I think there's definitely more to delve into. I'm hoping that there's more research on it. I'm looking like I'm going to go to the PE Institute this year, which is an annual event that convenes PE teachers from all over the country, and they meet, and I guess just, you know, it's like a professional development workshop. So I might attend that, and I'm hoping to get some stories out of there. I think bullying is a topic that, you know, it has been covered a lot, but it's clear that there's more to do on that front. So definitely a lot of follow-up stories to be done. Maybe I'll just write about PE and that's it from now on.
Your new beat.
My new beat.
I want to bring in some PE teachers, but you can call 816-235-2888 with your PE stories. Maybe you have fond memories of tossing parachutes in the air. Maybe you still shudder at the thought of being picked last for kickball. Either way, how did that affect you? 816-235-2888. So we have two gym teachers in the room. They're both trying to be really creative in how they approach PE. Nick Williamson teaches elementary school PE classes at Crossroads Academy Quality Hill. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
And we are also joined by Stephanie Dixon. She's an instructional coach for PE at all the KCK public schools, which means she is teaching the PE teachers and guiding overall philosophy. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. Good morning.
So, Stephanie, I'm going to start with you. What is the purpose of PE? What is it trying to instill? Just your own personal answer to that.
I think I've been in teaching for 21 years, and in that 21 years, it has drastically changed to be more, like Aaliyah said, more personalized fitness, student voice, student choice. We need to create kids that want to be physically active for a lifetime, not just K through 12. So we're trying to instill as physical education teachers those healthy habits, healthy lifestyles, nutrition, that physical component that physical activity is important. It's a huge job.
And what gets in the way of those efforts?
Resources. I think this article just kind of polarized the physical education community in a good way, because when you put money towards something, that doesn't mean that you're just going to get certain outcomes. I really wanted to, you know, see about the mission, the outcomes. What was the purpose of the grant besides just giving them money? And so I think it's really important that resources get in the way. Facilities. We have a lot of buildings in our school district that are very old, and so some gyms are over 50 years old, and so our facilities get in the way also.
And so you're also saying that it's been changing in the 21 years you've been in this field. How is PE changing?
Even when I was in fourth grade, I remember the balls that we played in dodgeball. And they were plastic, and they had Tachikar written across them. And they were, like, literally embedded in my forehead. And I broke so many pairs of glasses. And so I look back on that, you know, 44 years ago, and now looking what we're doing now, we have yoga, we have mindfulness, we have personalized fitness plans. We have very specific needs for our kids, because we all want to be – I think intrinsically we all want to be healthy. And so as physical education teachers, we need to arm those kids with lifestyle changes, how they can go home and help mom and dad go to the grocery store and shop. Or, hey, we have a couple minutes in between a TV show. Let's do some burpees, or let's do some
sit-ups. What are burpees? Like, this is the second time
they've come out. Like a mountain climber. I'll show you after the show.
Okay.
But they're kind of
– this is a new term for me.
Just anything to get, you know, 2 to 3 minutes here and there sporadically throughout the day to increase your physical activity levels.
So you're seeing PE not just as like I don't know. There used to be this idea, I feel like, just in my experience, like of sort of survival of the fittest, almost like
right.
Like it was almost like a gladiators or something in PE. Well, you know what I mean? And like now it just sounds like what you're talking about is educating people to be physical entities in the world and to take care of themselves and their bodies. That's not what I feel like PE used to be.
No, and it's not. And I mean, still there are facets. I think that's why this article was so awesome in many ways. The headline was crazy, but that, you know, once
headlines are always crazy.
Hey,
not my fault.
It got my attention.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, and so I think just having that, it has totally changed. And we do have facets of, just like in any teaching field, in any field that you go into, there are certain teachers that still roll out the ball. You have to get, you know, time a mile, and if you don't get it, you flunk the PE class. There are certain people that are still out there. And I think the people that are on social media and on Twitter and all those other things are really trying to increase awareness for teachers, for parents, for community members, just society as a, you know, as a whole segment, that we have to help. We have to help.
Well, Nick, you teach PE in the kindergarten to fifth grade age range, little kids. What are your goals for kids at that age?
So really the main things that I focus on are I want them to be excited to walk into the gym. And the other thing is I want to teach them how to solve problems. And so we talked a little bit about how it's such a social experience, and I really don't think that there's any better place than the gym to really focus on real life social problem solving. And so my goal is to get them to love moving and to solve problems.
So how do you do that? Give me some examples of like ways that you go about teaching those. Those are important skills.
So to get them to love moving, it starts with just making sure that they feel safe and comfortable in the gym, making them feel like they can take a risk. Most of the things that they're going to try in the gym, they're probably going to fail the first, you know, 5, 10, 20 times. And so if everybody comes in knowing I'm probably not going to be successful, and that's going to be the same for everybody, and it's going to be okay.
So setting the expectations in a different way.
Correct.
So you don't do like there was like a tone of voice that I would associate with gym teachers that is not like, if you fail, that's okay, is not the message in the tone of voice I'm recalling. It's like, come on, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think that there used to be kind of the stereotype is the old school PE teacher is more of like a drill sergeant.
Yeah.
Giving totally. You, you know, derogatory nicknames and, you know, punishing you by making you run laps or do push-ups, like that's going to make you enjoy physical activity more. And
yeah, by seeing it as a punishment.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious about your own experience with PE as a kid and what's inspired you to get into this field.
So I had the same PE teacher from first through eighth grade, and I really enjoyed it. I didn't grow up playing sports. I tried out for basketball in eighth grade. I was on the B team, and I was that kid that could never make a basket. I was lucky if I would shoot a ball and it hit the net. And so if you would have told me in high school that I'd graduate college with a degree to teach PE, I probably would have laughed. And I just ended up making some friends in college that kind of pointed me in that direction, and turned out that's what I was good at.
Do you think that that the fact that you're not coming from this like overachiever in PE kind of background helps you connect with a certain kind of student, a kind of student who maybe is exactly the kind of person reaching out to Aaliyah being like, I hated gym.
Yeah, absolutely. I always consider myself, you know, one of those kids that was just uncoached. I had no idea how to do things. When I joined basketball team in eighth grade on the B team, I had no idea how to dribble or shoot baskets. You know, and my dad went to the video store and picked up a Michael Jordan highlight reel. That wasn't very helpful, but, you know, his mind was in the right place.
And you remember those things.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's what led me to teach that way.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we will be hearing your questions, ideas, and stories about PE, how it's changing so it can teach what it's supposed to teach without traumatizing people. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And if you want to call in with your PE story, it is time to hustle. You can do it. Call 816-235-2888. We're joined by two local PE teachers, Nick Williamson and Stephanie Dixon, who are trying to change the approach to PE. Hi, both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
We are also joined by Aaliyah Wong. She wrote an article that inspired this conversation. It came out in The Atlantic, and it seems to have vindicated kind of a widespread hatred of PE. It referenced a study in a limited setting, it should be said, that did not show a link between PE class and overall fitness, and maybe even had some unintended consequences with discipline in school. Aaliyah, welcome back.
Thank you.
What are your thoughts, having heard what Nick and Stephanie have to say? And then we'll turn to our callers.
I was doing some burpees while they were talking. I also had to learn about them, too, because I'm far from the fitness expert. But I really appreciated both of their comments. I think they encapsulate exactly the type of PE educator that I really admired and tried to highlight in the latter part of the piece. I think one of the PE teachers I interviewed for the article was really optimistic about what he perceives to be this revolution in how PE is taught and designed, and that we're going to see a real overhaul across the country. I think, you know, it probably many schools are still stuck in that kind of 90s, 80s, or 1980s drill sergeant. You know, someone described it as a pit bull looking like a mean, gruff man. That kind of stereotype is slowly fading away. I think, you know, the point about resources is really important, because resources can't just be spent superficially or without thought. I think one thing that is a pretty widespread concern is general investment in PE. We've seen a decline in the number of public dollars that go into PE as priorities shift to greater academics. But as both of them kind of alluded, PE, when really done best, is kind of woven into the school experience and seen as complementary to, rather than divorced from, the other coursework that kids are doing.
Let's talk to Sharon, who's called us from Blue Springs. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
What's your story?
Well, when I was 9 years old in the fifth grade, I started my periods early and was held back from taking showers after gym class. And, the girls made fun of it, that I was a teacher's pet, and why wasn't I taking a shower? And many of them had never even been told yet about what was coming. And the periods and things.
Yeah, you know, and this is something that you seem to remember with a lot of, like you remember it very clearly.
Oh, yes.
In a way that you probably don't remember the dynamics around, like, math class.
Right, because this did continue for years. Even after the girls found out about it, they just still kept picking on me.
You know, I want to talk to the gym teachers here about this idea that, you know, part of what people feel about PE has to do with PE itself. But then there's like this broader PE experience that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your teaching. I mean, it's the locker room experience, for example. How do you manage that?
We have tried lots of different ways of doing things. I know that there's some districts across the state, across the United States, that have piloted programs where they don't dress out. And so they've had a whole gamut of different problems when they don't dress out. And then we have the other aspect that everybody has to dress out. Everybody has to look the same, in the same colored shorts, same colored shirt. And so that brings a whole different kind of set of problems. So maneuvering to the middle and finding that common ground of what makes these kids want to dress out besides a grade or participation. And then the safety issue, if you wear jeans that sag or belts or anything else that could get in the way.
Or a skirt that limits your mobility.
Of physical activity. So, I mean, I think it goes way beyond. And the article also said, you know, bullying really happens a lot in middle school because that's when you go through the most changes, emotional, hormonal, everything. And so we kind of have to focus a little bit on how we can maneuver that in the best way from a social emotional point of view. And I think that's where physical education, Nick, we're preaching to the choir kind of thing, is I think we need to figure out what best practices look like, you know, in that area.
We have a call from Caitlin in Kansas City who has thoughts about PE and what it should be. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
Tell me your thoughts.
I just, when I listen to people talk about physical education, especially in a negative way, I do want to acknowledge that it has come a long way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a PE teacher myself, you know, I've been through these trainings where we're really focusing on the academic portion of physical education. And I do find it frustrating when I hear people talk about PE, especially negatively, that they didn't have fun necessarily. And while it is a class where you're using your body and you need to learn how to play games and interact with others, it is still an academic class. So I wouldn't complain to my parents that I don't think math class is fun, because that's something that I have to do and learn to progress in life. And learning how to use your body, learning your foundational locomotor skills and how to move appropriately and effectively through life is just as valuable.
Can I just challenge you on that, though? Because later in life, I might continue to find math unfun, but I'm going to continue to be forced to do it, like when I'm figuring out a tip or when I'm doing taxes or all kinds of situations. I'm going to have to do math. Even hosting a talk show, believe it or not, I have to do a little bit of math because I have to hit time stamps in the show. So my question for you is, in a world where we are not forced to do physical activity, but it is very important that we have at least enough of a positive attitude toward it that we choose to do it, do you not think that having fun in gym class is maybe a responsibility of a PE teacher?
Well, I think that getting a student to enjoy whatever you're doing in an academic setting is important, because you want your students to be engaged and involved. But I would argue that what you're learning in physical education, especially at the elementary level where you're learning how to use your body, is something you're using for your whole life. You need to be able to run to catch a bus or to go up a flight of stairs appropriately. We're teaching kids how to throw a ball with their kids later in life. These are all foundational movements that, while you might not go on to be an NBA basketball player, you might not move on to be somebody that is super athletic or active in the gym, you still need to know how to effectively go through locomotor skills to carry yourself through life, even at the most foundational level.
Well, that I totally appreciate that point. I am curious about the role of fun in PE, and is that different than you would think it would be with other subject areas? I'm asking that of the PE teachers in the room.
I think it's easier to make the gym fun than it would be in the classroom. That's one of the easiest behavior things that I do, is kids don't like missing out on the fun, and so can't do that in math class.
And I think, you know, just bringing in music and just what the kids are doing outside and bringing it into the physical education setting is so important for them to start making those connections to the outside world.
What are your thoughts about, like, where gym is headed? We don't have a lot of time, but I am curious if this article in The Atlantic and hearing this outpouring of really, like, negative memories around gym. We do have positive memories. We have a tweet from someone who says that gym was her favorite part of the school day. It helped her get out pent-up energy. It helped her brain relax from academics. We all have another tweet saying our school in Lansing just started using things like dance and roller skating. Lots of positive things, but hearing all the sort of powerful negative memories around gym, does it make you think again about some things at all?
I think that always has to be in the back of your mind as any kind of educator, is how to elicit as many kids the engagement piece. Are we going to, you know, get all 100% kids all the time? No, but we have to reach at least 90%. We have to find what they're wanting, what they like, what they enjoy to do. And, you know, we have a fun little saying. We've kind of gotten rid of the fun in education because we're so focused on test scores and math scores and reading scores that we forget the most essential thing is to be healthy. Without health, you have nothing in your life. And so if we can start having little moments of time in school for kids to have fun, to be active, to be engaged, to be social. That's critical. That's critical for what we're doing.
Stephanie Dixon, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Jim Williamson, also a local gym teacher, thank you.
You're welcome.
Aaliyah Wong, staff writer with The Atlantic, author of a very contentious article about PE, thank you for inspiring us.
Thank you. I'm glad it was inspiring.
Up next, we will revisit our conversation with Bob Stewart about his poetry and plumbing and why he dislikes clocks that set themselves. Don't go away. Bob Stewart, or Robert, as it says on his book covers, is a poet, but he doesn't approach poetry as some ethereal thing. For Bob, being a poet is a hands-on, working-class endeavor. Just like being a ditch digger, a plumber's apprentice, someone who works in the sewers, all jobs that he's done in the past. His new book of poems, Working Class, drives that point home. In fact, the book starts with a poem that seems to be about masonry. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And Bob Stewart, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. And thank you for having me. I was thinking about this morning, that a new book of poems comes out. And for KCUR, for public radio, that's news. And that's pretty cool.
I think it's cool, too. What do you think is cool about that?
Well, it's not the kind of thing that the popular culture often acknowledges. So it's nice.
Well, talk to me about that first poem in this book.
That's a poem called Translations, a Psalm, and it's based on some language from Psalm 118, which essentially says at one point, the stone that was rejected by the builders has become our cornerstone. A couple of things caught my interest in that phrase. One is that it sort of embodies a paradox. And as a poet, I'm often interested in paradoxical situations.
What is that paradox?
Well, the stone that was rejected by the builders has become the most important stone. And so I got to thinking about not only that, but also the different approaches that people have taken toward translating that psalm, every one of them a little bit different.
You write in the beginning of the poem, you paint this picture of the people carrying the stones, and you get a sense of the weight of the stones as compared to the weight of the people carrying them, and a real feel for the work itself.
Well, that's the other thing that got me interested in this particular psalm, is that it reminded me of a work that I did when I was a younger man as a construction laborer. And in many cases, it always felt like we were just picking up stones and setting them down. That was my job all day. And so I got to thinking about this and about the work, and just jumped in and tried to make a poem out of it.
Can you read the last couple stanzas of that poem, starting with, "Those stones won't move themselves"?
Well, the quotes that I have in the earlier part of the poem from the psalm kind of phase into a language that my foreman would have used when I was working. And he would have said, "Those stones won't move themselves. We do agree. The sun burns the same for everyone. All true. Hard pressed and falling, gloves worn through to fingers, words hard as knuckles and now set. Get up in the morning and go. No one can do this but you."
You know, I imagined as I read that, and I don't know a lot about your story, which we're going to get into more, but I wondered if that was maybe kind of a credo for you as a poet as well. Get up in the morning and go. No one can do this but you.
Yes. It's kind of my way of living when I'm not feeling overly lazy. But I do believe that it's sometimes you just have to get up in the morning and go. And it's sometimes hard, and you just put in a day's work. And coming from a blue-collar, working-class background, it's putting in a day's work that has always meant something to me.
That's interesting, because I was wondering, if you would talk more about what the phrase working class means to you. It's how you titled your book. So I'm interested not just in your literal definition of working class, but how it fits into your worldview.
That's interesting because the title for the book came late in the process. I tried a whole bunch of other titles. They sounded false, pretentious. And I realized as I was looking through the poems in this manuscript that there was a working class sensibility and references to construction work, laboring work, plumbing. And it's that sensibility that I kind of surprised myself looking through it. And so so the phrase working class just had to be, it just had to be the title.
Well, so you do make a lot of references to blue-collar labor from your own experience, it seems.
That's right.
And how – can you talk to me a little bit about how poetry entered the picture?
I don't know that I can. No, I'm just – I'm sure I can come up with something. But my father was a plumber. My grandfather was a plumber. And I started out as a plumber. And I always believed that I was meant to be a plumber. But at some point, I just got interested in reading and intellectual pursuits and other kinds of things, literary pursuits. And I went in that direction, but I never really lost my connection to the working class world, to the people themselves, whom I loved and admired. And to the things that they taught me.
Like what?
Well, just as I said, get up in the morning and go. I used to, I had a, one of the foremen I had, a guy named Joe, who was my foreman at the St. Louis Metropolitan Sewer District when we were working in the sewers. I was working very hard one day, and I was all stooped over in a hole. And he grabbed me and he pulled me out and he said, "You're back." He said, "Take care of your back." He said, "Your back is all we're paying for. Take good care of it."
What does that mean to you?
It
feels like the way that you're looking at me, I feel like you hear poetry in that.
I do. And that was a sense of giving me a sense of reality of what the life is really like. And the same company, the sewer district, when I first took the job, he looked me over. I was probably not looking very tough and rugged.
How old would you say you were at this
point? I was probably 21.
And you didn't look very tough
No,
and rugged?
I was younger than that. Well, I was a college kid, you know, and decided to do some work for a while. But he said, "You're going to have to show up every morning and shake hands with a shovel." And I thought, okay, I got it. I know what you're talking about. So those are the kind of things that you pick up along the way, and or at least I did, and they meant a lot to me.
You know, you tell a story in this book about sitting with your wife, enjoying some wine and cheese, and telling her about the time you saw a rat face to face. And then actually you weave in a couple of rat stories from your own personal work experience.
That's right.
I am so, first of all, interested in the fact that you write about not the experience itself, but the experience of telling someone else about it over wine and cheese.
Well, that's an interesting observation. You know, I'll take any technique I can get into a poem, and that's just the way it started for me, and it went somewhere. It's a fairly long poem, so I can't read it here, but...
But is there, I guess I was curious about whether there is a sense of how these past experiences sit with your current life as you teach at a university, you edit a magazine, and not that this has to make it true, but a lot of people think of that as a whole different world from the world of working in a sewer and coming face to face with a rat.
Pretty different. But as a teacher of creative writing and as a writer myself, whether I'm at the university or sitting in a crew cab, you know, on a construction site, I think writers themselves are prone to like to tell stories. And when I'm sitting around with my wife and we're relaxing over a meal, I will lean back and start telling her stories, and she'll tell me stories. She's got her own great stories about farm life and working with horses. But, we're storytellers.
Well, tell the story of coming face to face with a rat.
Well,
tell it like you'd tell it to her.
Well, it was the thing that I noticed about this rat, and it was in an open ditch, but there was a sewer connected there, is how the rat was unfazed by my presence. It was as if I didn't really matter, and it was I wish I let me see maybe I can just read that one passage here, and it says, "My rat in the ditch kept coming. I told my wife, big as a fox terrier and slickened, not attacking but unconcerned by my existence, not blinded but indifferent, not, as the faith assured me, turning away, but ever growing up the climbing, the crumbling, sliding dirt, the sides, the ditch."
What did you do? Because that's kind of scary.
I scrambled out.
Yeah. As big as a fox terrier, you told her. Is that hinting at maybe that it was an exaggeration or just it's true?
I think that it's absolutely essential in poetry to exaggerate to a certain degree and to go to extremes a little bit. I have another example of a poem in which a policeman stops me, and he has a cross of ashes on his forehead, and it's Ash Wednesday. And I have a cross of ashes on my forehead. And we look at each other, and I say, this poem takes place in St. Louis, I say in the poem, this could only happen in St. Louis. Well, that's crazy. It's an exaggeration. But sometimes you have to say things that are a little bit outrageous.
Because it makes meaning of random details.
Yes. It's say that again.
It makes meaning out of random details.
Yes, exactly. And there's some validity to it because I grew up in St. Louis, and I always thought that the Catholic faith in St. Louis is deeply ingrained in the culture there, in a way that it isn't in a lot of other cities. So when I said that, it was an extreme statement, but there was just a glimmer of authenticity to it, I think.
There is a poem that I want you to read. It's a little bit shorter, and the reason I want you to read it is partly because it references daylight savings, but also because kind of what you were just saying about St. Louis, only in St. Louis, this poem has a place reference in Kansas City that maybe you need there, but maybe you don't. But I like that it puts us right in Kansas City.
I think that putting people in specific places is absolutely crucial to my work. And when I teach, it's one of the things that I find difficult to get across to students sometimes is to say, where are we? You know, what time is it?
And so in this poem, we're on 71 Highway?
Yes, I was returning back to Kansas City. I was going north on 71 Highway from a visit, and it was early in the morning, and I had realized that the time had changed and that I had gained an hour. And there's something about my nature, and I don't know what it is. We'll have another program on that, maybe. But I thought, you know, I'd rather lose an hour than gain an hour. And I really meant it. I really felt it. But it was such a paradox, as we were talking about earlier. I thought to myself, I think that's the beginning of a poem.
Well, read the poem, and then we'll talk about what it means.
It's called 71 Highway at the Moment of Change. I'd rather lose an hour than gain an hour. I'd rather be past than pass. I see a sign for the halfway cafe, too late. I'd rather turn around than get home. The one biscuit order of biscuits and gravy has two biscuits. I swear it's a mistake, but she says, no, no mistake. I'd rather be wrong than right. I tip too much rather than sour someone's pumpkin smile. Everyone has idle hands. My computer at home has set its own clock to standard time. Think about what happens in the hour that appears one morning, the hour that flies around the city looking like a bellows. I'd rather trust then know for sure. The sky's bright lanes peek through chinks in a barn. Water towers take to the top of the world. Streets run to the high 100s. Thus, I discover I am behind. I'd rather go to the seasons than they to me. I'd rather my computer checked before it did things.
Well, so that last line and a couple of others seems to get at a theme that runs through this book as well, another theme, and that is kind of a lamenting of the passing of the 20th century, and also just the mechanization and automation of things that maybe characterizes the 21st. Just, it feels like the idea of human effort, physical human effort, means something to you.
That's really a nice comment on my poems. I appreciate that. And it's something that I probably couldn't have articulated quite as well as you just did. But yes, physical work, any kind of steady work, it is a valuable thing to me. And I'm not always up to it, but I appreciate it.
Well, the phrase, everyone has idle hands, mm-hmm. the devil's playthings.
Yes. I don't know exactly how I would interpret that, but there it is. I don't know.
Well, so this gets at, you know, before we go, I want to read you a last little snippet of poetry that moved me. And I understand it's not so new. The poem is called No Theory for the 20th Century. And it kind of picks up on that theme, too. Leave me here in the century where I was born, the old century of levers, knobs, vacuum tubes, furnace stacks, scrubbers, and lead filling the sky, tons of lead, through which I sail like a bird, born with a mysterious cell in its brain for the route home. Who walks the 100 years? Voice commands, retina twitches, turn and return from satellites now, without bones or muscles or clear membranes that protect the eye. I suppose getting lost no longer will be possible. Or to be helpless and alone with only a prayer, or a raft made of railroad ties, which wobbles on a wave like love?
Thank you.
Talk about that. This ode to levers and furnace stacks and lead in the sky, that it's like love to be lost.
Exactly. Well, that kind of gets back to my sensibility, which is that I'm much more comfortable around physical objects, and I have an epigraph in the book from the French philosopher Simone Weil, absolutely unmixed attention is prayer. And I think that what she means by that is that when you pay close attention to things that are not you, and to people that are outside of yourself, that you are honoring them. And I wanted to honor the 20th century. I felt like at that time when I wrote the poem that we were focused on going away, you know, from that. And all the hard work and the dedication that people put into it, and also things that poem gets into.
So it's like the anti-multitasking.
Maybe so. I am fairly single-minded.
But, you know, a lot of people, I think, out there share your feelings, and a lot don't. A lot of people really embrace the new direction things are going. But for people like you who maybe like the idea of undivided attention and of physical effort that results in what happens instead of just a magical voice command or something, you know, that your computer changes your clock for you before you ever had the chance, that
right.
kind of stuff.
Right. I don't like that.
But what do you,
I'm just,
have you come to some epiphany about how a person is to move through this change?
Well, you know, I've done pretty well with it. I'm not a Luddite or anything. But I will say something about poetry, and that one of the characteristics of poetry is that it does connect a lot of diverse and unlikely things in one poem, and so I think maybe that's where I try to put my multitasking.
That was Bob Stewart talking to us about his book of poetry, Working Class, which came out almost a year ago. We just liked that conversation so much, we thought we would share it again today. And that's a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to our PE conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be ready for you by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you have any awkward gym class photos in your possession, we are accepting tweets at all times. Don't hold back. At KCURCST. Also, if you want to nominate yourself as a hot drink expert or an expert in gluten-free baked goods in Kansas City, you can do that on Twitter too, at KCURCST. Tomorrow, gambling addiction and a Grammy nominee right here in Kansas City. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.